Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. I'm your host, Rima Katz. Today we dive into the intricacies of the move towards instantaneous transactions, exploring the manifold benefits it brings while shining a light on the looming challenge, the surge in authorized push payment fraud. Drawing insights from the UK's 15-year journey with faster payments, we unravel the complexities surrounding authorized push payment fraud, a formidable adversary for banks. As we dissect why authorized push payment fraud poses such a perplexing challenge, we turn our attention to the critical role of inbound transaction processing in fortifying defenses against this evolving threat. Joining me today is Dave Scola, US CEO of Form3, and Tracy Kitten, Director of Fraud and Security at Javelin Strategy and Research. It's great to have you both with us today. To start things off, Dave, why is authorized push payment fraud such a challenging criminal activity for banks to solve?
So I think what's unique about authorized push payment fraud is typically the way we've structured systems in the past to monitor fraud has really been around the sender, right? So really trying to identify activity that may be fraudulent. Typically that activity would have been driven by account break-ins or some sort of break-in in security at the sender side of the equation. What's unique about authorized push payment fraud is the sender is actually sending a valid payment, valid in the sense that nothing has gone wrong from a technical or security perspective. Rather, it's been more of a kind of social engineering aspect, or there could be a number of different reasons why the sender is sending what they think is a valid payment. It's just the recipient is the fraudster. And I think what makes that challenging is that, again, most of the bank systems that are in play today have been geared towards monitoring the sender rather than monitoring the receiver. And that puts a lot more onus on the banks to kind of shift their position and start to look at the receiving end of that transaction, which is a change in posture for the industry as a whole.
Yeah, and I'll just piggyback on that. This gets a lot into, Dave, what we've been talking about at Javelin that revolves around educating the consumer. So there is obviously a technology piece that plays a role here, but there's also a human element, a psychological piece that's a big part of this. And I think part of what makes resolving the scam issue so challenging, because as you note from the FI's perspective, these are legitimate transactions. These are transactions that the users are actually authorizing. So these are authorized push payments, but because they've been manipulated, socially engineered in some way, they result in fraud. And so it's a huge challenge, and it's one that is only going to continue to get worse.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is that some of it is representative of the industry's success in stopping unauthorized payments on the other end of the transaction, right? I think, banks have done a great job at tightening up security and using two-factor authentication and all types of secure biometrics to make sure that the person who is sending the payment is in fact the authorized sender. It's just what's happening behind the scenes that's so difficult to monitor. And I'm sure we'll talk about client education and some of the other factors that go into helping to deal with that social engineering aspect. But it is very difficult for a financial institution to say, this looks like a perfectly valid payment from all the security metrics that we monitor. What makes this a fraudulent activity, right? And I think that's where it gets so complex for the industry. So it's a tough one. It's a tough one to solve. And we've certainly seen, and I'm sure we'll talk about the UK quite a bit and the examples that we've seen there and how they're dealing with it and what's happened in the faster payment environment. But it is a skyrocketing source of fraudulent activity that is difficult to deal with.
And on that note, Dave, why is inbound transaction processing key to addressing authorized push payment fraud?
Well, I think for the same reasons we were saying, it's so difficult to identify on the send side, it becomes much more incumbent on the financial institutions dealing with these payments to try and identify on the receive side, right? So I think with the commonality of the fraudulent activity is the recipient of payment. And so it becomes much more effective to monitor the receiving accounts than it is the sending accounts. Because as we look across the industry and the activity that's going through various payment rails, you can start to see similar types of transactions, similar amounts, similar times for these transactions that I think help reflect the fact that they are fraudulent, right? And it's working to identify those commonalities on the inbound side that make the identification of that fraudulent activity possible. So it really The difficulty is that on the receive side, the payment, the fraudulent payments can be coming from multiple different institutions, multiple different fraud vectors. The only way to really tie that together is on at the common recipient account level. And that's why we really need to kind of pivot as an industry to move from the send piece to the receive side to capture this activity.
Yeah, and I'll just piggyback on what Dave is saying. It's a huge challenge just for the reasons that Dave mentioned. And then let's keep in mind that all of this is happening in a near real-time or real-time environment. So that only adds to the complexity of the issue. But I think that some of those things that we've talked about in the industry for a long time, again, some of those tried and true methods can really be things that we can fall back on. I think back to the days of ACH, account takeover, and wire fraud. What were some of the indicators of compromise there? Well, we looked at, as you mentioned, Dave, the time of day of the transaction amount. If this were a transaction that perhaps had been initiated by a sender that doesn't normally have interactions with this particular recipient. So some of those types of things can assist, but again, it's such an explosive problem and we're not really going to get into it in the discussion here. It could be fodder for another podcast, but this is organized crime. I mean, a lot of the people waging these social engineering schemes are basically factory workers, a room filled with 30 people who are on phone calls. So you can just imagine how explosive this problem is. And it's very difficult to trace sender to recipient when you have so many people behind a lot of these types of schemes.
Thank you for raising that, Tracy. It's important to recognize the sophistication of the fraudulent actors in this situation, right? I think I was reading this article from Thomson Reuters about the scale of fraud in the U.S. and it places that it's somewhere around $10.3 billion. And even by that estimate, it's probably grossly underrepresented just because there's so many financial crimes that aren't reported just out of embarrassment or just a lack of appropriate mechanisms to capture it. But not all of that is in the authorized push payment space, but a significant amount is, right? And I think recognizing the sophistication and the scale of the activity here is important because these fraudsters will pivot just as quickly as we can, as the banks can, and as financial service providers can to find new ways to con their clients. And I think that's the banks need to recognize that scale. And I think the scale of investment and effort that's required in order to combat it.
Add to that, you both spoke about the challenges that many are facing. You spoke about what banks can do to combat this issue. What are some ways that banks can really address this?
So I think that Tracy mentioned the client education piece earlier. I think that is critical. I think these are always the outcome of this social engineering activity, which can only really be combated by making clients aware that these actors are out there and that there's common schemes that they're using to defraud people. But then I think on the bank side, beyond relying on clients to identify that, there's some other mechanisms that are starting to come into more popular use amongst the banks. And I think it's really, one is the application of AI. Frankly, I know everybody mentions AI as the solution to all things these days, but I really believe, particularly in the payment side, that fraud is the ultimate use case for AI. And the reason is, as Tracy mentioned, you are dealing with instant payment systems. They are irrevocable payments. They are happening within seconds. The only way you can successfully monitor that data at that speed is through the application of AI and really looking for commonalities among the payment activity that's going through the network. I think the other thing that's important for banks to think about is collaboration. Again, the actors will attempt the same fraud across multiple institutions, and it's only through the sharing of data across those institutions that the banks can appropriately identify these fraudulent actors and the accounts they're operating through and shut them down and hopefully trap the funds before they get further dispersed so they can be returned to the people that initiated these payments. There's other mechanisms that are somewhat effective as well. I think the use of confirmation of payee type arrangements. So in the UK, that's been effective, right? So before the payment's actually going out, you're confirming this is a valid account. There's the double check of, do you really want to make this payment? That helps. And then I think also at the account opening process, right? Banks are very good about doing KYC at the point of initiation of that opening of the account. But really what's required is an ongoing maintenance and an ongoing review of the accounts that are open on their books, because one of the well-known ways in which these actors operate is to open a number of quote unquote sleeper accounts, leave them dormant on banks' books for a period of time. So they kind of steep, if you will, and start to build up credibility so that when the actors go to use the accounts, they look like more valid accounts than they actually are. So there's a number of different things out there. I'm sure Tracy has others that we can add to that. It's not a problem that's going to be solved with a single solution, right? I think there's multiple attack points.
I'll just follow up on a couple of things. Monitoring the account throughout the account lifecycle, so important. I call it continuous authentication. I know we use that term kind of loosely, but to me, continuous authentication is you're constantly re-authenticating. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, we're not just talking about accounts being taken over. People change. They go through life changes. They go through divorces, or there could be a death, or there could be a job loss. And so there are things that impact different behaviors of different individuals. And it's just good practice to follow up and just re-authenticate those accounts and the users behind them just over the course of the life cycle of an account. The other thing I'd like to mention is to kind of circle back when we talk about what can banks do to address this issue. I think I'm going to take a little bit more of a return on investment perspective. And it goes back to something that you said earlier. They really need to get a handle on how much is being lost to scams. So you pointed this out, but we didn't really delve into it too deeply. But we don't have a handle on how much fraud is actually resulting from scams. And there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, one, to your point, it could just be embarrassment that financial institutions do not want to disclose how much is being lost. But I think a bigger issue is that we don't know. Everyone is tracking it in a different way. Some institutions only track it as a fraud loss if they have to reimburse the customer, or if they have to absorb the loss for some reason, because again, you know, this oftentimes is a first party fraud issue. If there are items returned and they get a charge back from the merchant. But in many instances where it's an authorized push payment, it's a legitimate transaction, the consumer may report it, but unless the financial institution has to reimburse that consumer, they're not tracking it in any way. So my recommendation would be anytime there's some kind of fraud or scam that's reported, that be tracked in some way or another. So we have some kind of grasp as an industry on how much is being lost or how much is potentially being lost. And then there's an opportunity for these teams to get some budget to make some investments in actually thwarting this issue, because that's another big challenge, especially when we're talking about fraud and cyber teams. They only have so much budget. The boards of directors and the C-suite are only really concerned about what's draining their pockets today. And so if we can prove that there's a lot of fraud that's going out the door, a lot of funds going out the door because of scams, and it's only going to increase, then there will be budget there to make investments to thwart these issues.
I completely agree, Tracy. I think that return on investment argument is critical, and it comes really in two forms. I think one is in some regulatory jurisdictions, they're starting to shift that liability to the banks more overtly, right? So we've seen that in the UK. There's certainly been some specter of that happening in the US. I don't know that it'll actually come to fruition, but I do think that there is that kind of overt kind of application of the liability onto the banks and making them responsible for that. But I think even short of that, and we talked about this a little bit in our prior conversation, the client satisfaction aspect of dealing with an institution that says, tough luck, you've been defrauded, it's your own fault, we're not doing anything about it. While some of that, I can understand the bank's position and that they didn't initiate the payment, they did everything on their side to make sure that the payment channel was secure, it still doesn't lead to a very satisfactory client experience, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you can start to see a situation where clients get very frustrated with their banks and start to shop around for banks that are perhaps a bit more sympathetic, let's say, or willing to reimburse clients for fraudulent activity. So that cost, while more difficult to assess, I think is also inherent in this fraudulent activity as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm just going to make one other point on that and then we can move on, because I know we could probably have a whole discussion about this in and of itself. But I was talking to somebody about this yesterday and customer service, what, you know, how important this is, right? And we always see this tension between digital banking teams and fraud teams, like when it comes to investment. But I'm making the argument that fraud is customer service. I mean, your customers and members are very concerned about fraud. fraud detection, prevention, and mitigation are key customer service points, right? And so we see from our data, and we've been doing this research for a long time now, moving into our 22nd year. So we have a lot of comparative data to show that consumers have a lot of trust in financial institutions. They have long-term relationships, but as soon as fraud results, it doesn't take long for them to close those accounts. That would be my message to financial institutions.
That's a good segue into our final thought and question here. We've seen a lot of organizations take a more digital first approach when it comes to fighting fraud. Dave, to kind of start things off, what are you seeing on your end and what key takeaways can the audience walk away with in terms of what they should be implementing?
Yeah, I think the challenge is against the backdrop of an instant irrevocable payment, right? That puts a lot of stress on traditional banking technology environments to do the necessary checks, right? And to apply the necessary technology to identify this fraudulent activity, right? So if you're operating on a 30-year-old mainframe system that has really no API integration, and it's very difficult to kind of institute some of the newer technology solutions within that environment, it makes it much more difficult to kind of implement some of these new solutions. So I think, never mind things like perpetual or dynamic or whatever we want to call it, KYC, where you're constantly monitoring your accounts and having to review them, it's very difficult to do in a traditional payment architecture. So I think what we're seeing with a lot of banks, and I think I saw a study, I think last week, that was released by PwC, it was specific to the UK, but it said something like 84% of banks either have a payment modernization agenda already in place or are planning on funding one within the next 12 months. And I think that's reflective somewhat of this onus that's being placed on the banks to stop fraud and compete in an instant environment. So long story short, I think a lot of the banks we see looking now to more and more to leverage API integration to start to tie together kind of best of breed technologies, microservice environments where they can start to piece those together using the APIs to integrate, and increasingly leveraging the cloud for scalability and speed in activities that were kind of anathema in the past for banks to move off-prem. So payments, right, which is our, at Form 3, it's kind of our whole modus operandi, right, is helping banks move their payment activity into the cloud. And the take-up of that has been pretty significant, and we expect it to only continue as banks try and create environments that allow them the flexibility to start to monitor things like APP.
Yeah, and I'll just add to what you're saying there, Dave. You know, again, this is yet another example of where the US can learn from the UK. So similar to what we've seen, you know, with EMV, we're going to see the same thing with real-time payments. A lot of the institutions that I spoke with nearing the end of last year had done nothing as far as technology advancements, improvements to address the launch of FedNow. And so this has been backburnered again. Budgets are tight, a lot of fraud issues to look at. And again, unless they're really seeing losses that they can track and put on a budget line, it's difficult for them to really pay attention to it. But I think that's going to quickly change as we see a lot of losses linked to faster payments. And my hope is that there will be some investments from a technology standpoint that banks at least start to plan for and forecast here in the U.S.
No, agreed. And if folks who are listening in wonder why we keep pointing towards the UK and other regions, it's because they just have a longer track record than we do, right? With faster payments, with instant payments. And I think part of the concern is with the launch of FedNow, right? And I think the uptake of RTP and the growth of Zelle, it creates whole new use cases for businesses, but it also creates whole new use cases for fraudsters, right? And I think it's just inevitable that as those instant payment rail solutions grow, we will also see an uptick in fraudulent activity. So I think rather than deny that that is kind of part of the inevitable growth of these solutions, we need to walk into them with open eyes to make sure that we're protecting the clients as much as we possibly can.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights and perspective. And thanks to everyone for tuning in today. Be sure to subscribe and stay updated on the latest Payments Journal episodes. And don't forget to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues.